Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Something happened on America's roads around 2009. The number of deaths of pedestrians struck by vehicles started rapidly rising. By 2019, deaths were at their highest in 30 years. And then came the pandemic. You'd think the pedestrian fatalities would have dropped. But think again. Controlled for miles driven, they rose another 20%. So today, we're asking why American roads have become even more dangerous for pedestrians and, yes, cyclists too, and what can be done to fix it now. Take Philadelphia's Roosevelt Boulevard. One out of every five pedestrians killed each year in Philly dies on Roosevelt Boulevard. In 2013, Samara Banks and her children were trying to cross the boulevard. They were struck by a driver drag racing down the street. Samara and her three kids were killed. LaTanya Bird is Samara's aunt. She co-founded Families for Safe Streets Greater Philadelphia, and she joins us now. Ms. Bird, welcome to the program. I understand that it's just a couple of weeks ago, it was the sixth anniversary of Samara's death and the children's death, and I can't imagine that it gets any easier as the years pass.
Hello. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's been 8 years. However, it seemed like it was just yesterday.
Yeah, sorry, 8 years. Forgive me, I miscounted there. Time is going by.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened that night in 2013?
Well, it was a really hot summer day. Everyone who remembers that day know that. And Samara and the kids, Sadeem, Sashawn, and Samir, were leaving my sister's house. And on their way home, they went to cross the Roosevelt Boulevard. And, they felt safe. And also, there was another niece and another nephew with her. The two of them made it across. However, there were two drivers approaching who were obviously speeding for quite some time down that road. And when they came to where they were crossing, it was a dead on crash. And the other drivers who were along, driving along with them, actually thought it was debris in the road. But it just happened to be my niece and the children. It was devastating and actually unbelievable. We lost two generations that night.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the road and why people cross it, and what it's like on a daily basis there?
Well, it's a thoroughfare through the city. It's a flat open road. However, there are residents around that road, so people would have to cross if they would like to go to the supermarket or if they want to go to the pharmacy. It just seems like everything is always on the opposite side of the road. There's also along that stretch areas where there isn't a pavement, Mm-hmm. However, people have to walk at least, a block or two to try to get across, to cross at a crossing light. The road, when you live in a neighborhood, you're not really thinking of that road being dangerous because it's in a residential area and there's no way you can get across unless you maybe go 6-7 or so many miles down the road to catch a bus, just to get across the street. Mm-hmm. So living in a neighborhood is different for people that do not. When you live in a neighborhood, you feel safe because that road is there and you can cross, However, people who's driving along the road are not adhering to the speed limit. The speed limit is actually 40 on some stretches, and then it goes to 45. So that is, so people, by being flat and open, they feel, I guess, the need for speed. Some people, although they shouldn't, and they should know the pedestrians. And I mean, I'm just saying, and residents, people live in that area. So as time went on, strip malls and several like big department stores opened in that area. Okay. Which meant which I believe the developer should have thought about, okay, we have residents in this area. We're going to bring more traffic to this area. How can we protect them? And that is something that's been happening for years. Now, I was not or did not know most of the people who had died along the Roosevelt Boulevard. You hear it so often that you don't really think about it. You just think it's a crash, it's an accident. And no one ever really looked into why these crashes happened. So the neighborhood, the community actually told me that they have been fighting for safer streets in that particular neighborhood where my niece and nephews were crossing. So I listened to them. I also, the Bicycle Coalition of Philadelphia, Greater Philadelphia, had reached out to me, and we together, and we decided to travel to Harrisburg. We talked to several representatives on both sides of the aisle to see if they would listen to our plea to do something about that road.
And were they receptive to that? Because I read a little, as I told listeners a little earlier, that 20% of pedestrians killed in Philadelphia every year are killed on just that one road. That ought to grab lawmakers' attention, right?
Yes, it should. You know, and a death is, you know, most people don't truly feel the pain that we have gone through unless it happens to one of them or someone close to them. So what I did was, when I went to Harrisburg, all those trips, I took pictures of my niece, of the children. And I said, these are people, you know, you never know. We don't wish anyone bad luck, but it could be your mother. It could be your child. It could be your neighbor, you know, so we need the safety on the road. And we I had written personal letters to different constituents during the voting times where they were hand delivered to say, hey, you know, here's my family. Look at them. You know, you have the power to do something. And that's what we did. And it took years. I mean, years. So I believe it was just, you know, with the COVID happening, I believe it was just maybe a year and a half ago. We finally, after all the fighting, we finally got 9 of the speed cameras up along that stretch of the Roosevelt Boulevard.
I see. And what difference did that one change make?
Let me tell you, 240,000 plus people received tickets within, I guess, maybe let's say a 3 or 4 month period. After 9 months, you wouldn't believe it, but the ticket rate dropped by 93%. Huh. Now, we knew that that happened with the red light cameras when we put them up. There were tickets, people were getting tickets all over the place. And then putting the red light cameras up actually helped. The red light cameras and the speed cameras are helping to save lives.
Wow. But as you say, those two changes, as hugely impactful as they've been, took years to get into place. Years of advocacy, and after the deaths of people that you love. And so, last question for you, Ms. Bird. I mean, what's your message out there to other communities who are trying to make their roads and sidewalks and intersections safer for pedestrians?
Well, you have to be consistent. You have to be determined. You have to, you know, understand why it's important for us to be able to, you know, freely, you know, just live in our communities and feel safe. One thing that we do know is that we really need federal leadership. We need their commitment to zero deaths. And basically, there's a couple of things going on in the Senate and the House where we need them to, you know, help with passing the infrastructure bill, which I think they're there, which is great. And the surface transportation bill. You know, there are roads actually, you know, these cities and states, they have to list predict how many people they believe are going to die on the road in order to get the funding they need. And that is outrageous. You know, there's one bill where trucks will be, you know, exempt from requiring automatic emergency braking. You know, and in the EU, you know, that has been a requirement since 2015. You know, all around us, other nations are doing something about this, and we need to listen and step up and be that voice.
Yeah. To take meaningful steps towards solvable problems. I mean, it's such a powerful message. LaTanya Bird, co-founder of Families for Safe Streets Greater Philadelphia, thank you so much for joining us. And I am once again truly sorry for the losing the your loved ones. But thank you so much for sharing your story.
Anytime. Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Cleveland, Ohio, where Angie Schmidt joins us. She's author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Angie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've got about a minute here before we have to take this first break, but what does LaTanya's story and the story of what's been happening to pedestrians on Roosevelt Boulevard in Philadelphia tell you? What's significant about that boulevard?
Well, there's roads like that in almost every city where there's a wildly disproportionate share of pedestrian deaths or traffic deaths in general happening on one road or a small handful of roads. So while the problem might seem overwhelming, we know where the problems are, and we know it has a geographic component. It's not our tendency has been to blame the victim when this happens. But when we look at where these occur, there's a very clear pattern. And what that tells us is it has a lot to do with street design and other socioeconomic factors.
Okay, so what we're going to do when we come back is we're going to talk about what that pattern is, what the causes of, or what the factors are that are creating that pattern. And of course, we're deeply interested in what we can do about it to save lives. So this hour, we're talking about the sharp rise in pedestrian deaths that have happened in the United States since about 2009. We've got a lot of comments coming in online, and I'll get to them as the hour progresses. So hop on Twitter and Facebook and let us know what you think about keeping pedestrians safe on American streets. We're at On Point Radio. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about why, beginning in around 2009, pedestrian deaths, or walkers hit by automobiles in the United States, started rising dramatically, so much so that the U.S. is near a 30-year high in those pedestrian deaths. The nation has essentially been moving backwards when it comes to safety of people walking alongside U.S. streets. And we're getting a lot of comments online here. Here's two different views. This is from Jeff Phillips, who says, I hit a pedestrian in a crosswalk a long time ago. I think it's even worse nowadays. Jeff is looking to pedestrians themselves, saying they never make sure that they see that cars can see them before they walk, especially with texting. It's even worse. Jeff, I would say I've been on the other side of that, trying to make eye contact with drivers. And it's almost impossible these days, because what is everybody doing behind the wheel when they're at an intersection?
They're looking at their phones. And here's Robert Bonato, who says, as a pedestrian, I've jumped out of the way of texting drivers, phone talkers, and particularly people who don't slow down when they're turning. I mean, they don't slow down at all. So technology there on both sides of this deadly equation. Chris from Albuquerque, New Mexico, called us to tell us how she was struck by a car just last month.
On July 14th, my dog and I were hit by a car when we were walking home from our morning walk. And I think it very much directly had to do with the intersection being an extremely dangerous intersection. There's not even a crosswalk there. It's an intersection near the University of New Mexico, as well as a middle school.
Well, my guest today is Angie Schmidt, author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. So, Angie, first of all, I'd like to just sort of set the terms of what we're talking about here. How does the U.S. compare right now to peer countries in terms of annual pedestrian deaths?
So overall, compared to our peer nations, we're a real outlier in traffic deaths in general. So there's some countries in Scandinavia, for example, where they have about one-fifth as many traffic deaths on a per capita basis as we do here. And even Canada has about half the per capita traffic fatality rates we have here. So if we could do just as well as Canada, we could save about 20,000 lives a year. And over time, our record compared to peer nations has been eroding. A lot of nations in Europe and Asia have seen much more rapid increases in traffic safety compared to the United States.
Wow. Okay. So now we know that there's a legitimate comparison here to make, and the U.S. has a long ways to go to get to the place of safety for people walking as peer nations. So let's talk about some of the factors behind that. You had mentioned geography. Can you dive into that more specifically? Where are the most dangerous places for pedestrians in the United States, both regionally and then, of course, within those communities as well?
Right. Okay. So there's a few different things going on. The most dangerous states in the United States for walking, there's a report every 2 years by Transportation for America. They'll do the top 10. They're all Sunbelt states. So these are places like Arizona, Texas, Florida. I think sort of intuitively we understand these are places with wide roads. These are places that developed. A lot of their growth took place sort of at the height of the auto era in the United States. So compared to a Boston, for example, that matured around streetcars and sort of a walking environment, those places are more dangerous. And I think that partly explains this trend we're seeing, because those are the places, almost without exception, that are the fastest growing in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there's also a trend.
Lots more people. Yeah, lots more people in an infrastructure not built for so many. Yeah, got it.
Right.
Go ahead.
Like in Houston, where they have huge growth, you know. Also, there's a trend going on at the metro level where it's talked about sometime and referred to as the suburbanization of poverty. And that's a big sort of underlooked trend in the United States. But about half of poor people in the United States now are not living in urban areas. They're living in surrounding suburban areas that were really designed sort of, again, in the previous era, with the expectation that everyone would have two cars and a white picket fence. And now people are kind of stranded out there without the infrastructure to really support their needs to live without a car if they find themselves in that position.
Okay. So more people living in rapidly growing places de facto. And then, as you said, the suburbanization of poverty as well. Again, in neighborhoods that were built, especially during the rise of America's love affair with the automobile, right? But and
right.
So is there also a kind of political problem here? Because it sounds like the neighborhoods you're talking about also suffer from a political invisibility. I've heard it called, I think, in fact, you also even mentioned it in your book, as politicians having essentially a windshield bias. Do I have that right?
Right. There's another trend that we see very clearly. Like where I live in Cleveland, if you map out neighborhoods of color, if you map out Black and Hispanic neighborhoods where there's been historically redlining in some cases, and then you map out the most dangerous roads in Cleveland, they overlap almost exactly. And we see that in city after city where The most dangerous roads are concentrated in lower income neighborhoods and in neighborhoods of color. And those communities aren't getting the resources they need to keep them safe.
Well, because their problems are invisible to the people who could help solve them. So we're going to come back to this political will question in a second. But I wanted to talk about road and intersection design a little bit more with you. I mean, how would you describe sort of the, in fact, even the design culture around these places over time in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a big problem. So we have all these sort of institutional norms, all of our funding formulas. They all are designed, they all cater to drivers to an enormous degree at the expense of people who are sometimes vulnerable. And often when the trade-off is very little time savings, we haven't been willing to make very minor sacrifices for better safety for all of us. So one of the groups I kind of pick on in the book is there's a engineering manual called the MUTCD. And that's one of the ways these biases, the sort of favoritism for drivers, is hidden and institutionalized in our laws.
So tell us more about that. That's the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices.
So it's an engineering manual. And like I said, it's the law. So it's a federal regulation. And they're just updating it right now. But one of the things this book says is it instructs engineers not to install a crosswalk with a traffic signal, which I think most of us understand to be the most safe and comfortable place to cross, unless 93 pedestrians per hour are crossing at that location. So this is before we've even installed a safe crossing. We need this really, really high volume of pedestrians to justify delaying drivers for a few seconds with a traffic light. Failing that, the guide says if three people are struck at that location in 4 years, then a crosswalk with a traffic signal is warranted. So that's just one of the ways this bias towards reducing driver delay at the expense of pedestrian safety is sort of institutionalized and became part of industry norms and even our laws.
Well, it sounds like you're saying that to put it harshly, pedestrian safety is almost an afterthought because people have to die first before the justification for putting in safe crossings arises.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so that seems to be an obvious place to try and maybe effect some change here. You said that the MUTCD is up for revision soon or now?
Yes. It's going through every 10 years. It's revised. And I was part of a big campaign pushing for some big structural changes in that document, some reforms. And we're really hopeful with the new administration, Pete Buttigieg will sort of seize the moment because that's an opportunity we have to really elevate safety sort of across the board in a way that would be cost effective, because really it's just changing the rules, just changing the way we do things.
Okay, but there is kind of there's a deeper culture here that I think has been part of America for more than half a century now. Has it always been this way? Has the bias in terms of design and regulation always been towards automobile drivers or car drivers and not towards pedestrians, or was it different in the past?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting history here a lot of people aren't aware of. There's a guy at the University of Virginia, a historian named Peter Norton, that wrote a really interesting book about the early history of the auto era in the United States. And, if you look back to the 1920s, cities where I live, like Cleveland or Philadelphia, they were largely walking cities. And the streets sort of functioned as a social place at that time. Children would play in the street. Neighbors would stop and greet each other. Sometimes people sold goods from carts in the roadway. But over a short period, once people started adopting cars in big numbers, all that activity was supplanted. And while that happened, after the introduction of the Model T Ford, that kind of thing, a lot of people started getting killed. All of a sudden, there's thousands of deaths on the roads in Philadelphia, in Cleveland, and Baltimore. And a lot of the deaths were children. So there was actually a big backlash. And at that time, the impulse was to blame the driver if someone was killed. Peter Norton does a lot of research where he digs up old newspaper clippings, and they would refer to drivers, for example, that killed someone as a murderer back then.
Wow. Okay. And so obviously that changed, though, because now we're, as you write in the book, most regulations are written for the intent of vehicle passenger safety. And then when it comes to road design, to help, you know, move those vehicles around before pedestrian safety and pedestrian convenience are considered.
Right. Yeah. They eventually, some auto-oriented groups introduced this concept of jaywalking, and that was the idea. Prior to that, there weren't even any crosswalks. You know, that was a very new concept. And this idea that pedestrians should only be in certain locations, and even then, only when there was no traffic. So that was a very effective in reframing sort of who streets are for. And now we think of streets as mainly a place for cars. And if a pedestrian is struck, the attitude, sort of the knee-jerk impulse, is to blame them. Well, why were they in the road? Even though we all understand if you're going to walk anywhere, eventually you're going to have to cross the street.
Right. And I mean, what's so remarkable about that, remarkable in not a positive way, is that as time goes by, especially in many urban areas in the United States, you know, we're seeing more people wanting to walk, and let alone those people who already have to because it's their only option, or, you know, the rise in bicycle commuting as well. So roads are very much mixed use in this country. I mean, right where, very near where I live, there's basically a 4-lane roadway with a light rail in the middle of it. And I have trouble crossing that street because the pedestrian light is not long enough. And so you get halfway and then you're stuck in between the cars and the light rail. And the pavement area for pedestrians to stand is in some places maybe only a couple of feet wide. So you're like kind of hoping and praying that you don't either get hit by a car or get hit by a train when you're waiting to cross the street. So I mean, we get a lot of comments along those lines here. David McAllister says, I'm a physical therapist with elderly clients. 21 seconds is not sufficient enough time to cross in a crosswalk. I stood before the Disability Council and spoke in Bristol, Connecticut. The Disabilities Commission is still studying to look for an increase of just 9 seconds in the crosswalk that could make the difference. So there are just so many factors to think about regarding how to make streets safer. Are things like even just changing crosswalk timing, though, hard to enact in the United States?
Yes, that's a very good point. And again, it goes back to some of the standards. So engineers are trained that people will cross. It used to be 3.5 feet per second, which that's kind of the speed, the walking speed, or 4 feet per second. It's kind of the walking speed a middle-aged, pretty fit man would cross. So there is a bias. They're designing for a certain kind of people, and people that don't fit into that profile might find themselves at risk, including older people. And I think, you know, the United States is aging, and older people are vulnerable, and as are people with certain kinds of mobility disabilities. So as we see that population growing, I think that partly explains why we've seen this rise, and we need to do a better job for them.
Okay, so there's two more really important factors about why we're seeing this dramatic rise in pedestrian fatalities. And it begins around 2009. So here's Rhonda, who called us from Long Beach, California, and she told us what she thinks.
The reason why I think there's a rise in pedestrian and auto collisions is because people are not paying attention. They're mostly on their cell phones or their navigation map or whatever. I walk almost every day, and it never fails that almost every day I'm almost hit by somebody not paying attention.
How much do smartphones play a role here, Angie?
You know what? It's a little bit difficult to say. I think it's probably is a factor, like everyone is calling in and saying. But I don't think pedestrian distraction is too big of a problem. I think driver distraction is the bigger problem. And I can explain why if you'd like. But one thing that's
interesting
about...
I think Rhonda was saying that that it's drivers who are on their phones who are distracted, yes, that she's concerned about.
Right.
But go ahead.
Yeah, people do make sort of the claim on both sides. Yes.
Yeah.
So I do think that probably is a factor. We're too permissive about it. We could do a lot more with technology to prevent it, and we just haven't. We've just refused. But it's a little bit hard to know because we don't have very thorough crash examinations in the United States. So we usually don't. If someone isn't killed, we're usually not doing a detailed enough reporting process to really determine how big of a factor cell phone distraction might have been. But yes. I think there's actually it's not all one thing. I think there's actually a number of trends taking place at the same time that all contribute to this problem.
Okay. And so the other big trend we're going to talk about when we come back from the other side of this break. But why do you think that people look to cell phones as kind of one of the most immediate factors that they think are causing this? I mean, it's just because everyone has one, but it doesn't explain what's going on in the United States, because all the other countries we talked about that are actually reducing pedestrian fatalities, Canada, several countries in Europe, they all have cell phones too, right? So like we can't, right, that can't be the reason here.
Right, that is true. So if you look at other countries that have the same sort of smartphone penetration as us, other high-income nations like the UK, they haven't seen this same trend. So there is something different going on here in the United States. Although we do know that people who do have cell phones use them a lot while they're driving, and it is very dangerous. So people are not wrong about that.
Okay, well, Carl Denham says, ironically, in my neck of the woods, the biggest threat to pedestrians is coming from the rogue cycling community. Another person, Annie Merrill, says, there's too many disconnected parking lots with no walk paths and shopping areas, 5-lane streets to cross timed at 7 seconds for crosswalking, yet we wonder why pedestrian deaths are on the rise. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today with Angie Schmidt. She's author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. And by the way, those deaths are on the rise. The U.S. recently reached a 30-year high in the number of pedestrians killed by automobiles in the United States recently. The number had been going down in the 90s. And then around 2009, it started trending strongly upward. Now, that's quite interesting, because what happens in the United States around that time and in the subsequent decade? Well, it's the mass adoption, even more than it was before, of the SUV. So here's Indianapolis TV station WTHR reporting on the problem of blind spots in front of SUVs. With the help of an organization called Kids in Cars, they got mothers behind the wheels of their SUVs and lined up kids one by one in front of their bumpers to see what the mothers, again, behind the wheel saw. And here's part of that report.
Lindsay Berry drives a Cadillac Escalade.
Oh my goodness. That is so scary. I can't see any of them.
A dozen kids, and she can't see any.
This is just mind-blowing. I can't believe it.
Not until child number 13 lined up in front of her SUV could she see the very top of his head.
But yeah, I can't see any of the other children at all.
The size of that blind zone, 15 feet.
I am in shock. I had no idea this blind spot existed.
And that's one right in front of their cars. So, Angie, how much does car design have to do with the dramatic rise in pedestrian fatalities?
It's really the factor that we can point to most clearly and say these two things are connected.
Tell me more.
So we've had this enormous shift. If you look back to about 2010, when we're coming out of the last recession, about 3 in 4 new cars sold at that time were sedans. So they're like Honda Civics, a regular car. Now, if you look forward to the most recent year, it's a complete reversal. Now, a lot of car companies have totally phased out sedans, and SUVs and pickup trucks account for about three quarters of new car sales. So what that means, practically speaking, is pedestrians, when they're struck, are struck with heavier vehicles, and the vehicles have higher front ends that hit them higher on the body. So if you are a pedestrian and you're struck in the legs, that's less likely to be fatal than if you're struck sort of in your sternum, directly in your chest.
Mm. So they're bigger, they're taller, they have more mass, too, so the force of the impact is greater. But ironically, a lot of those things and the significant advances in vehicular safety have made those very same automobiles safer than ever for people inside the cars. And that's by regulation. Do we have similar regulations in the United States for those SUVs and trucks to be designed for pedestrian safety?
Right, we do not. So in the United States, we regulate vehicles for safety. We have pages and pages, you know, of these federal regulations, things like seatbelts, airbags. We've never imposed any regulations on automakers specifically to benefit pedestrians or cyclists, people outside of the vehicles. So all, you know, everything that's cushioning drivers when they get in a crash, we've never applied those same kind of principles to the outside of the vehicle, although they have done so in Europe.
So there's not one single regulation that says a car manufacturer has to think about the impact of an object, the impact on a person outside of the vehicle in a crash?
No, they voluntarily agreed years ago not to do hood ornaments anymore because those really mangle people. But it was never an official regulation.
Are there even tests that go on, like crash tests during the design phase? We've all seen the videos of crash tests of what happens to people inside the cars, but are there crash tests for outside, for pedestrians?
Yeah, no, they don't do that. They don't do that. NHTSA does not do that. So no one in the U.S. really even knows for sure. Like, we haven't tested different models on how we can sort of use data from the field to determine which models might be safer or more dangerous to pedestrians. But we don't do that simulated lab testing in the United States really at all. So we're sort of guessing, whereas in Europe they do. And it's incorporated into Europe, it's called NCAP. That's the 5-star vehicle safety ratings. So late in the Obama administration, they had proposed including pedestrian safety impacts in those 5-star vehicle safety ratings. And they were getting ready to move ahead with it. Some automakers liked it, some didn't. And then the Trump administration came along and they quashed that.
My pause there is just that one can't help but to be frustrated to see actually how many advances the auto industry has made in safety, right? They have incredibly smart engineers. They can do this. And if they were required to, they could add pedestrian safety into the mix as they design cars. It just takes federal wherewithal to do it, but we haven't even had the political will to make that one change.
Right. It's very disappointing. But there was a study that the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety did, and they found that a package of advanced vehicle technology features like automatic emergency braking and pedestrian detection installed in Subarus reduced pedestrian insurance claims about 35%. So that's pretty good. And these are relatively new technologies, and they're not being held to a specific standard right now by the federal government. So we could do better than that. Some people think we could save as many as 10,000 lives a year just by requiring existing vehicle technology that we don't require in the United States.
But as LaTanya mentioned earlier, for example, the automatic braking technology you talked about, that is required right now in Europe. Is that right?
I believe so. I'm not 100% sure about it. Actually,
okay.
In the infrastructure bill that the Senate just approved, they have proposed requiring it in a couple years' time on commercial vehicles only. So that's a small step forward. But we really ought to be requiring it in all passenger vehicles. It has a tremendous potential to save lives for relatively little cost.
Yeah. You know, so amazing. The automakers are, they're global. They're global companies. They're making cars for different markets. They're making the same sort of roughly type of car for different markets. So they can act, they know how to do this already. So I want to turn now to someone who's doing research in automobile and vehicular safety overall. Sue Bai joins us. She's chief engineer and division director at the Honda Research Institute USA, part of several working groups in the U.S. made up of automakers and cities to connect cities and vehicles on the internet in an effort to prevent collisions with pedestrians or crashes with pedestrians from happening. She joins us from Traverse City, Michigan. Sue, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna, and would like to thank Angie for the great book I recently read. I've learned a lot from that.
Well, so we're really interested in seeking out solutions here and not just sort of continuing to complain about the problems. So can you, Sue, describe to us a little bit of the work you're doing specifically around this idea of connecting cities and vehicles together through the internet to make streets safer for pedestrians?
Yes, we see connectivity as an essential piece of safety technology towards a collision-free and fatality-free society. And the connectivity benefit is to enable communication among pedestrians, infrastructures, and vehicles. We talked about, Angie earlier, her talk mentioned about the smartphone. It can be a device to empower pedestrians to communicate with vehicles in structures. For example, people with special needs now have a way to communicate with other road users. I'm riding a wheelchair. I need more time and space to cross the street. And for example, public safety workers that often not being focused on. There are more than 150 construction workers on average being injured and killed every year. And they now have a way to warn the drivers approaching traffic, saying, I'm doing road construction or police directing traffic. They now have a technology to empower them to be protected even more.
Well, Sue, so if I understand correctly, you've got some test intersections essentially running now in places like Ann Arbor. Can you describe to us specifically what's happening in those locations?
Yes, in addition to Ann Arbor, and this is a great example of a collaboration among automakers, industry stakeholders, and governments. One of the intersections we built in collaboration with Ohio Department of Transportation, City of Marysville, and Union County is called the Smart Intersection. That's using the infrastructure camera to detect pedestrians and wirelessly communicate those pedestrian information to approaching vehicles and other pedestrians of the pedestrians' walking pattern and their direction of walk. So on the receiving side, if the vehicle is equipped with the same technology, it can warn the driver even when the pedestrians may be at the non-line of sight situation when the view can be blocked by other traffic or in the inclement weather condition.
I see. Okay. But the key thing is that the vehicle has to be equipped with technology to receive that information. Is that
correct?
Are you using technology that's standard in new vehicles already, or is it something that has to be added voluntarily by car owners?
It's coming up. The standards is already set. It was published by in 2017, and Honda lead the effort, but that standard is already used globally, not just the U.S., there are many other places in China and Europe are deploying this technology as a pilot.
Okay. So definitely more connected cities, connected intersections could be an important part of this picture. But that also seems kind of, to be frank, a long way off, right, Sue? Because it's going to require mass adoption. It's going to require cities across the country to be on board. It's going to require more of the technology to be in cars. And you can't really grandfather the old cars in that don't have it. So are there other things, other ideas that you think might be more quickly adopted to make streets safer for pedestrians?
Well, I think in general, safety technology take a long time to mature, and that we are also working with a major carrier such as Verizon Wireless to explore another possibility of a similar approach using 5G technology. And it could be a complement to the typical V2X technology that are piloting globally. And these are a great example of pushing the envelope towards the next generation.
Well, Sue Bai is Chief Engineer and Division Director at the Honda Research Institute USA. And as you heard, she's part of several working groups in the U.S. made up of automakers and cities trying to connect cities or test out what it would look like to connect cities and vehicles on the internet to prevent collisions or crashes with pedestrians. Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Angie, let me turn back to you. What do you think about sort of more connected cities, more connected vehicles being part of the overall solution here?
So I'm actually really excited about that, vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure communication. I mean, we could stop cars from running red lights, for example, or cars from crashing. So, and actually it's not sort of as far off as you would think. Toyota was ready to go making this technology, at least the availability of it, standard in their cars a few years ago. And then there was some mixed messages from the federal government that's a little bit confusing that set back the technology. But another thing that's really cool about it is it can be applied retroactively. So you can install it in cars that already exist. Whereas with automated vehicles, a lot of people have pinned a lot of their hopes for safety on automated vehicles, which we don't know if they'll ever be road ready, really. And then with the case with those, we really do have to wait with automated vehicles for the entire vehicle fleet to turn over, which takes about 11 years.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the automakers see this challenge overall? Because for other issues, they've both been leaders and have drastically opposed major changes to requirements for their cars. I'm thinking, you know, for example, with emissions standards. It was only, a year or two ago that GM joined a lawsuit by the Trump administration to hold back California's desire to increase its emissions standards. And then when the Trump administration left, GM dropped its involvement in that. So they have shown a history of being rather resistant to mass changes in requirements for their automobiles. What's their view? How have you interpreted what their view is on making changes for pedestrian safety?
So it varies by the company, and a lot of the foreign companies have a lot of cars in markets where they're required to have better safety, like in Europe or Asia. So, and the American companies have specialized more in trucks and pickups, and so are a little less focused on that. So, but I do think in general, the auto industry has been a bad actor in recent years. And again, it varies a little bit by company, but they've been making these big windfall profits by convincing everyone to trade in their sedans for SUVs. They can sell an SUV, a crossover SUV, at a $10,000 to $15,000 markup over a sedan. And they cost about the same amount of money to make. So it's been very, very profitable for them. And in a lot of cases, you can see that they've clearly designed the front ends, especially of pickup trucks, to look very aggressive and very menacing. Now we see them being used sort of to, in a lot of cases, to attack and intimidate protesters. So I think that they've tapped into some sort of malicious impulses people have and profited from it. And they could do so much good if they took the safety stuff more seriously compared to a lot of that kind of thing, you know, the style stuff or even the little frivolous bells and whistles like heated seats and heated steering wheels.
Mm-hmm. So we've got about a minute left here. Just to sum up, the United States is moving backwards in comparison to peer countries when it comes to pedestrian safety. You've well established that, Angie, which I just think is a shame. We can do better than that. The problem should no longer be hidden in these communities that don't necessarily have the political voice to be heard, as we've talked about. But things keep coming back in the last 20 seconds that we have to, you know, is there the political will to even just change some basic regulations? Do you think you're seeing that, at least a start to that, in, say, the opportunities in the new infrastructure proposal?
You know, I am hopeful about some of the things the new administration has done, and there's definitely some progress, I would say. And it's not the home run we hope for, but there's definitely some progress on these issues. So I am hopeful.
Well, Angie Schmidt is author of Right of Way, Race, Class, and the Silent Epidemic of Pedestrian Deaths in America. Angie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.